This is Spectrum.
Alternative Medicine, Homeopathy, Secret Society, Hypnosis, The Paranormal, Alternative Energy, UFO Abduction, The Weird, The Wild, and The Wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan, here with my co-host, Tom Theophanis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Hey, Scott, I'm good. How you doing?
I'm doing awesome. Well, we have a great guest tonight. He was making his second appearance on the show. Tom, could you read his bio, please?
Certainly. Well, tonight's guest is Lloyd Pye, who's an author, researcher, and lecturer in the field of alternative knowledge. He calls on over 30 years of experience to write and speak about the origins of life, human origins, hominoids, Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Yeti, and others, and the work of Zachariah Sitchin. This broad base of knowledge makes him one of the world's leading proponents of the intervention theory of origin, which stands in sharp contrast to Darwinism, creationism, and intelligent design. His studies led him to conclude humans cannot possibly have evolved on Earth according to Darwinian paradigm. But by age of 40, belief that compares skeletons to the so-called pre-human fossil record with those reported to be belonging to the world's four basic types of humanoids. Lloyd is also the caretaker of the famous Star Child skull and has written a new book about his 8 years of struggle to get it scientifically tested to establish beyond dispute the precise genetic heritage of both of its parents. Let's welcome Lloyd Pye.
Hello, Lloyd.
Hi, guys. How are
you?
Hey,
Lloyd. How are you?
I'm fine, Tom. Good to be here with you.
Oh, thanks for coming. Thanks for coming. What we'll probably start out with is what we always start out with is a brief history. We're going to be talking about your new book, Intervention Theory Essentials, that just came out. What date did that come out? That was October 11th?
It was really last week, last Wednesday, actually.
Yeah,
okay. So it's not even quite a week as we're speaking. Or
are you getting a lot of good feedback?
Yes, I'm getting very good feedback, but I had a feeling that I would because Everything You Know Is Wrong, it's sort of an update of Everything You Know Is Wrong, a book that I wrote back and published in late 1997, so that's about 14 years old. And that book still sells very consistently without me really promoting it at all. It just sells strictly by word of mouth by people who see videos that are on YouTube that I did 10, 12 years ago, and people see those videos, and to them it's new, and so they jump right on it and buy the book and read it. So there are a lot of fans, you know, it's a big fan base out there, and in fact more people consistently week in, week out, month in, month out, check on my Everything You Know Human Origins material on the internet more than they do the Star Child. So I knew there was a market for it. I knew people wanted, and I would get emails all the time, when are you going to update? When are you going to revise? When are you
going
to? I know.
I was one of those people sending you that email.
And so I've had, you know, literally thousands of those, but I just stay so busy with the Star Child, but I decided to just make some time and do it because it was just such a demand for it. And I expected it to be really 150, 200 pages at max of ebook pages, which, you know, are not that long, not that complex. Yeah. And it ended up being 352. 50, yeah. So it got away from me in that sense, but there was just so much to cover and to do it right. It just had to be that way, but I'm very pleased with it. Those who have read it are very excited about it. Very pleased to have seen it. You've seen it. So
yeah,
you know.
I've read it. I gotta say, I love the quality of it. You've got a lot of illustrations, a lot of pictures. You're spelling everything out, and you cover it pretty much from a cosmological beginning to human origins and you know, the intervention theory pretty much laid out from A to Z, and it's great.
Well, what I think basically is our conception, the average person's conception of reality, is so abysmally wrong that from end to end of everything that we think that we know that's big, you know, the really big things like how the universe formed, how the solar system formed, how life came to be on Earth, how advanced life came to be, how humans came to be, every bit of that, every one of those things I just said, stone cold wrong, bad wrong, ridiculously wrong. And everybody feels like those things have all been answered long time ago and that they're not even worth questioning. They're so right. And it's just not true. And so that's what I've tried to do in Intervention Theory Essentials, which is to just show the essential aspects of what you need to know to understand the reasons why those things that everybody just takes for granted are in fact wrong. We are the equivalent of the flat earth people of 300 and 400 years ago. And I know that sounds astounding to the average person to think that we could be that abysmally ignorant about the world around us. But we actually are. We are just that deeply, deeply brainwashed into believing one set of realities when in fact those realities could not be more wrong. And as you saw in the book, I just go through case by case to show the difference and why it is that way. And in it, you know, in its own way, this book is about as radical as they come. It really is.
Oh yeah.
But it also makes its points, I think, very clear. And I don't think anyone that reads it is going to come away from it thinking anything other than, you know, this guy's probably right. So I'm very satisfied with it.
Yeah, the academic community loves to make things rules and laws. You know, Einstein's theory of the speed of light, it's a cornerstone. And I got a quick joke for you. Bartender says, "We don't serve neutrinos here." Neutrino walks into a bar.
Oh, I got the speed of light. Yeah, that's a good one.
So, you know, I mean, they have to keep sort of changing their rules and nudging the science a little bit further out, you know, to incorporate their archaic thought patterns that have been around for hundreds
of
years.
Well, you know, it doesn't really happen that they do the nudging. What happens is people like me nudge them, and it's more than nudge them. We really have to just kick them really, really hard in the butt or whap them upside the head.
It's like playing whack-a-mole, isn't it? Yeah.
They don't go quietly into that good night. They do not give ground easily at all on any of these points that are the essentials. Like, for example, that speed of light thing that you mentioned, which has just recently supposedly been broken. But the one that I talk about in the book, of course, is gravity. Everybody, you know, science is just absolutely wed to the idea that gravity is the binding force of the universe, the thing that holds everything together from the very start when particles began to aggregate in the vacuum of space and began to then make bigger pieces and aggregated into bigger pieces still until it all clumped up together into suns and planets and solar systems and galaxies and all of that, none of which is true. Gravity does not have the power to do that. As force, it is just incredibly weak, particularly at the granular level where it all had to start. I mean, you don't just start with planets and suns and all that out there. You have to start with grains. And at the granular level, gravity doesn't work. So what does work? Well, they know what works. That what works is electrified plasma. But if they bring electrified plasma onto the stage, then gravity has to go. That means Newton has to go. That means Einstein has to go. It means they have to start over from scratch, and they don't want to do that. Who would want to do that during their watch? So the bosses of the community of cosmologists and astrophysicists just sort of gang together and say, okay, well, we know we're wrong here, but I don't want to go through the relearning process and the upending of the whole theory and starting over from scratch. I don't want to admit to the world that I don't know what's going on. Let's just keep pretending as long as we can and the train wreck will occur maybe when we're no longer in charge. And that's kind of the philosophy of everybody who's in charge of every aspect of science that is wrong about some fundamental aspect. They just don't want the train wreck of change to occur while they're in charge. So they put it off and put it off and put it off every way they can. But the day of reckoning comes, you know, for everyone eventually, for all of these things that we think we know now, it's going to be like it was for the flat Earth, or for the Earth being the center of the solar system and the center of everything, and all those things that have been upended with great turmoil and conflict. I mean, even in the early 1900s, you had plate tectonics, where Alfred Wegener, a German meteorologist, came up with this astounding study that explained how the Earth's, I mean, everybody knew that if you took what you saw on a globe and you cut the pieces out and you shoved them together like puzzle pieces, they sort of kind of fit pretty doggone good. And so it looked like you could just see it, that the Earth had been all one piece at one time, and, you know, that the land had. But Darwin, not too long before that, 50 years before that, Darwin had just rattled everyone and everything with his theory. And so nobody was in the mood in 1915 to acknowledge that the Earth itself was completely unstable, even though you're having earthquakes, you're having volcanoes. I mean, you're having every bit of evidence that you need to indicate that the Earth is not really all that stable. They just completely ditched Wegener's theory of the moving plates and for another 50 years, until it just couldn't be denied anymore, when they went out and took some magnetic readings at the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and they found that indeed he had been right, that it was true, that it was happening, and they had to acknowledge it. But generally, change in science comes with the death of two generations. I mean, that's just the way it works consistently. When a new paradigm is first introduced, like Wegener's, it's a classic example, but it's not nearly the only one. You have those that are in charge. When the new thing is put out, they will fight it tooth and nail until they die.
Yeah.
The new generation coming up will be split. Some will go along with the teachers, will go along with the old guys, will buy completely into it, and will believe the old way of thinking. But some of the new group, you know, maybe 50-50, are going to think, you know, I'm open to this. I have an open mind. I see problems with the old system. I'm going to provisionally accept the new one. And they'll begin to at least talk about it to graduate students. There'll be some teaching, and the word will begin to spread. Now, that second generation dies out, and all the kids that were coming up, they were hearing it, and they were, you know, it wasn't taboo to talk about it or to contemplate it. And by in about 50 years, whatever the truth was, it's self-evident. They just go on as if it was never, there was never any doubt about it. All of these things that I talk about in Intervention Theory Essentials, all of these things are going to be that way. Now, I don't know how much of it will be accepted in my own lifetime, but all of it will be ultimately, eventually. Now, if you were to have, for example, a Bigfoot be killed or in some way, I don't know that you're going to be able to get a video or pictures or anything like that acceptable in the world of Photoshop. Because
right.
Science will just say, poof, Photoshop, doesn't matter how good it is. If they sit right down and talk to you across from a campfire, they're not going to buy it. You know what I mean? So,
right.
Well, not that they could talk to you.
They could hoot at you.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Make noises and stuff like that. Exactly. They're not going to buy it. So it's pretty much going to take a body or something where you are getting some physical part of it. Maybe if you yanked off a clump of its hair or something and got some roots out and could get the DNA off of that. But even then, they might doubt that. I don't know.
Right.
But there will be these things are all going to happen. Alien reality is going to happen. Hominoid reality, Bigfoot and the others, that's going to happen.
Let's not get too far ahead. Let's save some stuff.
All right.
Okay, well, I did say we were going to start with some history, so let's do that. How did you get involved in these areas of research? There must have been something when you were young that steered you in these directions.
There was. I was a senior in college at Tulane University in New Orleans, and I was just going through the library one day in the stacks looking for something else. I don't remember what it was. And I just saw this book that said Abominable Snowmen, Legend Come to Life by Ivan T. Sanderson. A big, thick book. And I just saw it. And I had, by then, by 1967, 68, that was all in the news because the Patterson film had been taken in 67. So I was aware of it. We all were aware of it at that time. And then I saw that book, which had been out, the Sanderson book had been out since 61 or 62. So people had forgotten about the book. So I got the book and I read it and I was absolutely blown away. I knew that Ivan Sanderson was famous, a famous zoologist. I knew that he was on the old Jack Parr show, which was prior to Johnny Carson. But Ivan Sanderson would go on the old Jack Parr show, and so he was well known. And I didn't realize what a tremendous researcher and writer he was and what his body of work was. So I read that, was absolutely fascinated in that, and then started reading all of Sanderson's other works. And I was just hooked into alternative knowledge right then. And I just never got off of it, even though I lived for 20-some-odd years trying to, you know, be a normal person, trying to be a writer, went to Hollywood and was a screenwriter and did all that. But I never stopped the studying as I was able. Without an internet, it wasn't easy to get information, but wherever I could find it, I would soak it up. I just had a passion for it. You know, you just, some people do, some people don't. And I just stuck with it and kept piling it into my head and not really knowing what I was going to do with it. I just did it because I loved it for fun. And then in about 1990, someone told me about a book called The 12th Planet by Zechariah Sitchin, which had been written in 1976, but I missed it. I didn't get it then, but I got it in 1990. So when I read that book in 1990, I had already, in my hominoid research, I had understood that hominoids were, in fact, what we were being told by science were pre-humans. All those things, the Australopithecines, the early homos, Homo erectus, Homo habilis, all that, those they were saying were pre-humans simply because they walked upright. But in fact, all of their bones said they were primates. So I knew that those so-called pre-humans were all the ancestors of hominoids, of living hominoids, of Bigfoot and the three other kind. But I had no way to prove it. I had no mechanism. It was kind of like what the shape that Wegener was in 1915 when he produced his book. He knew what had happened with the plates. He knew the plates had moved, but he didn't have a good mechanism for how it did happen. He didn't have the mechanism. He was missing the mechanism.
You also didn't you also see in the 70s a ice-encased Bigfoot?
Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah. I did. I mean, that's why I'm saying circus, I was convinced. Say again?
It was a traveling circus, I believe.
It was just like a road show. It was a county fair, actually. It was part of the 1976 celebration of the American Centennial, actually. He would the guy with it would take it just to county fairs, to big events, and, you know, like you buy space in a booth at a conference. He would just, you know, pay the people putting on the event, I guess, some fee to set his thing up, and then he would make his money by charging people to come in and see it. So I saw the Minnesota Iceman in 1976, and that was part of the process of convincing me that hominoids were, in fact, real living entities on this planet, and that it was their bones that we were recovering in the fossil record. So what I came to understand by 1990 was that humans did not evolve on Earth. I was absolutely certain that we didn't evolve on Earth. But I didn't have a mechanism like Wegener. I didn't have a mechanism for how we got here. And then I read Sitchin's book with his wonderful explanations of the Sumerian texts and I was absolutely blown away. I just knew this is it. This is it for me. I now have the front end or the back end, however you wanted to look at it, of my own research. And on top of that, I knew that I had something Sitchin didn't have. Sitchin believed the mainstream viewpoint of how of evolution, of how humans came to be here, up to the point of where the Anunnaki came and began to genetically engineer what was on the Earth at the time, right, which he believed was Homo erectus. And I disagreed with that part of it. I believe that he believed that the Anunnaki came and created out of Homo erectus Neanderthals. And I felt and still do that I knew better, that Neanderthals were in fact part of the process, and that the first humans didn't come on board the planet until now they call them the early humans prior to Cro-Magnons, but you know, Cro-Magnons at about 200, whatever they were at about, right, 200,000 years ago. So I knew that if I blended my own research into hominoids with Sitchin's work, with what he was doing, I could come up with something that would be absolutely unique and fundamental and a game changer in its own way. And so that's how I came to write Everything You Know Is Wrong. And that book has done very well because people who read it see very quickly the sense of it. You know, it just makes sense in so many ways. And so the new ebook, Intervention Theory Essentials, is building on that that fundamental understanding of how many things around us are wrong, and trying to show and explain to the reader, if you just follow my logic here, if you just follow what I'm trying to tell you, in the end you're going to see that the whole of what I'm saying is right. And that's how they come away from it saying, you know, yeah, it's probably is right. So that's pretty much goal achieved, and it's just now a matter of waiting for the word to spread out to more and more and more and more people so that they get those who are open to it. Now let's keep in mind, this is not for everybody. This is the kind of thing that if you're very, very locked into a religious belief, let's say, or a scientific belief, or anything like that, where you just are convinced you're right, then this is going to be, this will be alarming and upsetting, and some people are not happy with it. They'll read part of it and write me back and say, what are you trying to do? Cost me my religion? Or, you know, and chew me out. Well, you know, not really, but that has a chance of happening. It really does. And to some people it does, and they're okay with it. So it's not for everyone. You got to have kind of an open mind, a questing mind, and not be locked into one of those paradigms or the other. You can't be really locked into the religious viewpoint, and you can't really be locked into the scientific viewpoint, because this book will rattle your cage really badly if that's where you're coming from.
Yeah, one of the things that I was always, was saying in the past, that anything that we always claim that we think we know is going to probably change in the future. And that has happened throughout our history, and I'm sure it'll be happening again. So your ideas right now with this will probably be proven right in the very near future.
Well, I don't know, Tom, whether it'll be the near future, but I think over the course of time, what people call the fullness of time, I don't have any doubt that every one of the major fundamental issues that I'm discussing, that I'm challenging science on and saying that they're wrong on, I have no doubt that in the fullness of time, every one of those will be vindicated and shown to be correct. And that's really what's exciting to me, doing this kind of work. And I'm not the only person who does this kind of work, obviously, but I'm excited just because I know that I'm going to be remembered as on the team of people who who were at the forefront of making the change, you know, making changes happen, or at least putting it out there so that the wedge, you know, we're the people that create the wedge that drives in and ultimately topples, you know, the ignorance of the past. And you were right in what you said earlier about things changing. All of science is nothing but one long series of mistakes that are then corrected.
Yep.
That's really all science is. It's going from one bit of knowledge and then proving that one wrong because some new one is right, and then proving that one's wrong because some new one is right, and it's building all the time toward, you know, ultimate truth. And I don't, you know, there's some parts of what I'm doing that are only going to move the ball into the next, you know, to the next step, like this gravity thing we were talking about. We're going to go from gravity to electrified plasma. But what comes after electrified plasma? We have to acknowledge that, work with it, come to understand it. But then is going to come what? Warp speed, you know, hyperspace. I mean, we're going to move, yeah. But we can't get from where we are now with gravity, which is stone tools, you know, really, literally, gravity is the equivalent of an intellectual stone tool when you're going up against the universe. And what obviously the UFO people, the people who drive the UFOs, what they're using is, you know, machine guns compared to stone tools. That's how far they are ahead of us in understanding the reality of space and time and speed and light and all those things. But we will not drop the dadgum stone tool. Our scientists keep clinging to that stone tool, and they won't let it drop, so people can start moving to the bow, which is going to be probably the electrified plasma. You start figuring out how to use the bow, and then somebody's going to figure out how to use gunpowder. And, you know, we're going to move our way up. But we can't get to the bow, and we can't get to the gunpowder till the people with the stones in their hands get them knocked out. And that's what I'm trying to do. And I'm not the only one. The whole electric universe crowd, I'm a reporter on that. I'm not even a researcher. There are wonderful researchers, and I mention them in the book, and I give links to what they do, and I show their books and things like that. There are people out there doing tremendous work. I'm just reporting this, but it's material that I've studied that I believe and I'm convinced is right, and I think that everybody that takes a closer look at it will see for themselves. Blindingly right. No question about it.
Yeah.
Well, for the most part, I think, you know, we humans think too much of ourselves. I mean, we think we are the center of the universe.
It's a very comforting thought, isn't it? To think that we're, you know, that quote that I have at the very
beginning. So we know everything already.
Yeah, that quote that I have in the beginning of the book is that, you know, just the height of arrogance is that us, which are, you know, we're just basically bags, skin bags of water and muscle and things like that, and we're on a very, very inconsequential planet and a very inconsequential solar system and a very inconsequential galaxy, and that we stand here and we look up at all of that and we think that all of that is there so we could exist. You know, it's the absolute height of arrogance.
And
all that's out there,
and the God guy gave us only.
Yeah, you're right. And we are so poorly designed and so poorly put together and so inept in so many ways. I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is we have over 4,000 genetic disorders. Over 4,000 genetic disorders. Now, you know, if we're going to be divinely created, he could have cleaned up a little bit of those, don't you think? I mean, chimps have
a few hundred.
You know, chimps have a few hundred. Most animals, if you're not a domesticated plant or animal, and one of the things that I talk about extensively in Everything You Know Is Wrong, but not in this ebook, I couldn't talk about everything in the ebook to the extent that I pick it apart and do in the in Everything You Know Is Wrong. If I tried to do that in ebook, it would have been over 1,000 pages. So, I mean, you know, I had to be realistic about it. But I do talk in Everything You Know Is Wrong extensively about domesticated plants and animals and how different they are from the natural species on the planet. And one of the things that's most different about them is they have enormous numbers of genetic disorders, which is why even Darwin himself said, when you really, really look at close at human beings, we're like domesticated animals. He said that before anybody had even a blink of an idea that, in fact, that's exactly what we are. We are a created species, genetically engineered, created to be slaves and servants for those who created us. And I talk about that extensively in Everything You Know Is Wrong, and to a certain degree in the new ebook. But in the new ebook, I try to stick more with the logic of the genetics, you know, because genetics, we know it so much better than we did 15 years ago when I was doing the research for Everything You Know Is Wrong. So that's why I say in the ebook, I've tried to update the areas where I didn't really know or things have developed in those 15 years so that I was able to make a really, really nice addendum to the book Everything You Know Is Wrong.
Yeah, well, I mean, you didn't just stop collecting information 15 years ago. New stuff just keeps coming and coming.
Exactly.
But in the book, you went back even further. You went back to the point of an intergalactic terraforming.
Right.
So let's go back. Let's take it back.
Well,
to
you know, in the beginning of the solar system as, you know, we understand it now, and I pretty much can't be sure of anything really, but I believe it makes sense. It seems plausible that at about 4.5 billion years ago that our solar system began to coalesce into itself as we understand it. The planets began to form into the protoplanets. The sun, you know, was the sun, and yeah, the general sort of shape of the solar system at 4.5 billion years ago. And at about 4 billion years ago, literally a half a billion years, when the planet is still basically a cooling ball of lava, just seething lava, where you wouldn't think, and nothing should be able to live at all, certainly not form itself in water. You know the old story about the building blocks of life are in water and
they're lightning bolt.
Lightning bolt, exactly. Isn't that clever in the...
So there's no clouds, but a lightning bolt appears.
Yeah, lightning.
Yeah. You saw the Campbell soup can of the primordial soup, lightning bolts not included. Did you see that? I love that picture. But yeah, the primordial soup, getting struck by the lightning bolt, all that story that they still tell, that's what they still teach. No, they know. They've known for decades that's not what happened or how it could have happened. But nonetheless, they still teach it because it's just simple and it's kindergarten level, and why challenge people to think beyond that? But the truth of it is that at that time, at around 4 billion years ago, a mass of bacteria, one-celled, single-celled, prokaryotic bacteria, just appeared here, just boom. I say they were dumped here. They had to be dumped here because there wasn't just one kind. There were two kinds. This is like the equivalent of a load of dogs and cats being dropped down. They just boom appear, and they're there, and the first rock begins to form is found at 3.8 billion years ago, and the first life forms in that same range. I mean, first fossils. So we know they were there from the beginning. Now, what were they? They were indestructible bacteria. They could live as they do today in any of the absolute worst environments on the planet Earth today. You have what are called extremophiles. They can live in anything. That's what we got when we needed it. When the planet was just beginning to coalesce, it got a dump truck load of life, or dump truck loads, or just a massive amount.
Yeah.
And what did it do? What was its purpose? What was the purpose of the prokaryotic single-cell bacteria? What did they do then? What do they do now? They produce oxygen. they produce oxygen. Now, what do they need to produce oxygen for? Because iron, if you're going to take a protoplanet and turn it into a habitable, livable place, the first thing you have to do is you have to tie up all of the free iron and with oxygen and turn it into rust, because iron is very, very reactive with oxygen. Anything you put out there that's iron, what's going to happen to it? Just overnight, if it's not covered, not painted, whatever.
It rusts, yeah.
Boom, rust, exactly. Very, very reactive. So all of the free, I mean, and iron is one of the most abundant elements in, apparently, in the universe, because everywhere they look, there's iron and plenty of it. So the iron for any planet that's going to become a planet that's going to house higher life, the first step, and it's a couple of billion year process too, is to lock up all the free iron with oxygen. So what do you do if you're a terraformer? And this is what I suggest, that, that terraformers are out there. If you're a terraformer, what do? You bring prokaryotes and you dump them on all the planets, not just one, but all the planets in a coalescing solar system, because you don't really know at that point which ones are going to end up in the zone of life. You're not sure how the sun is going to shrink down. You know there has to be a zone of life, and so you just put them on all of them, and the ones that are in the right place are going to work, and you'll come back and you'll keep working with it, and you'll bring new things and you'll make life go on the ones that can support it, and that's the way it works, I assume. So the terraformers, in the case of Earth, they brought it, came back in a couple of billion years.
Okay, or they just switched on the time travel thing, and in like 8 minutes they were.
I don't know how they did it, but a couple of billion years later they come back and they find that the Earth is now ready for the next kind of life that it can support. Now there's enough oxygen there for eukaryotic bacteria to survive. Now, what are eukaryotes? They are a much bigger, much more complicated, much more complex form of bacteria than are the prokaryotes. The prokaryotes have their DNA floating around loose inside their bodies, a few hundred strands floating around loose. Eukaryotes have a central nucleus, the cell nucleus. We human beings, all animals, all plants, all life, other than prokaryotic single-cell bacteria, are eukaryotes. We have cells with nucleus holding our DNA. So it starts with the eukaryotes. But still, for another billion and a half years, it's just the prokaryotes and just the eukaryotes. Why? Because the eukaryotes can they're much bigger and can put much more oxygen into the atmosphere. It's all about pumping oxygen into the atmosphere, because once you tie up all the loose iron, what's the next step? The next step is you have to build an atmosphere and build an ozone layer, because without an ozone layer, higher life forms can't live on the surface of the Earth or in the water, or, you know, the near surface of the water. You're not going to have life until you have an ozone layer. Right. So Once they have the prokaryotes for 3.5 billion years to building, setting the planet up, terraforming it so that it now is ready to receive higher forms of life, what happens? What do you think happens? Boom, it appears, the Cambrian explosion. The Ediacaran biota come for 15 million years, but we don't really understand what they were, and they weren't.
Yeah, they were just like big flat mats of big
bags of. We don't really know what they were, but they had a, don't get me wrong. They had a job to do, probably in all likelihood, just more oxygen. But when it was time for a kickoff, for real life to come, boom, the Cambrian explosion, which to this day no scientist really pretends to understand. And they all know they can't explain it in Darwinian terms, because Darwinian evolution requires precursors, something sort of kind of like everything that came before. And it just isn't there, because the Cambrian explosion is literally thousands of species of animals in the seas, in the water, not on the land yet, but in the water. You were talking males and females. We're talking predators and prey. We're talking endoskeletons, exoskeletons. We're talking the whole gamut. Nearly all of the animal phyla that we have today came right then in that one massive, maybe a thousand years, maybe a million years. There are people that argue for all they're worth that it's, maybe 10 million years. Doesn't matter. It's overnight in relative terms. You go 3.5 billion years approximately, and then boom, overnight, the Earth is crawling with new animals.
Right.
That is not Darwinian evolution at work. That is a miracle. And
right. Then a miracle happens. It's part of the equation, isn't it?
Exactly.
This happens, that happens, then a miracle happens, and then you have this.
And I wish you'd be more specific in step two. Yeah, I know. It's a great cartoon. But that's really the story of how it happens. So the thing about the terraformers, if you go with the terraforming theory, and that's what intervention theory is about, that Earth is the result from beginning to end of intervention from outside the planet. And if you go with the terraforming idea, it means that the terraformers have embarked on basically a 4 billion year program of development for this planet.
Or now, with time travel, like a week and a half.
Well, I'm not even going to say, obviously there's probably something like that, but there's still time for them. What I prefer to think is that time for them is irrelevant. It doesn't have the meaning that it does for us. Obviously there's probably no beginning, no end. There are very godlike qualities to these beings, whatever they are, but I don't think they are the ones that created us specifically. I think that is very likely to be the Anunnaki that Sitchin talked about, or maybe something else bringing us here. In other words, there's probably scales of labor involved in this, but the ones that began the program and the ones that oversee the program, the terraformers, the ones that I call the terraformers, they are just of another category of being entirely. But they know what they're doing, and they apparently do it right. Because here we are to talk about it, to speculate about it. And if there wasn't somebody overlooking this, I don't think it could just happen. It's too complicated. It's too complex. When you really begin to understand life and how it works and how the gene code works and all of that, and I talk about it, try to break it down in the ebook so people can understand it in simple terms to see how easy it is to explain the things about Earth, about human genetics that make it so indicative, so clear that we have been genetically engineered, that we are not a natural a species of planet Earth. We are very, very unique. We're not the only one that's been genetically engineered. There are many others, domesticated plants, domesticated animals. But we're in that group, and it's clear in our gene code that we have been genetically engineered.
Shouldn't there be some evolutionary precursors, some evolutionary adaptations in the fossil record going from literally, I guess, with the prokaryotes and eukaryotes and the third one with the big mats?
The Ediacaran biota.
They throw those names out there just to mess with us. Yeah. Shouldn't there be, like, how do you go from, they're basically plants, right? I mean.
Right.
How do you go from that to, like, sea animals?
You don't. That's the whole point of the Cambrian explosion. There is no transition there. There's no transition possible. It's a layer, a level of complexity like the stone in the hand, the stone tool, and a nuclear bomb. I mean, it's a level of difference from the prokaryotic bacteria and the eukaryotic bacteria to say a nautilus. I mean, those are the kinds of things that appeared in the Cambrian explosion.
And nautiluses are still around.
Nautiluses are one of the few from the Cambrian explosion that are still around, exactly. It's just absolutely incredible. And if you really look at those creatures that came in the Cambrian explosion and you look at reconstructions of them and how people think they looked and all, it's like they all look from another planet. They look, you know, like nothing like what we have now. And they really did probably come from another planet. They were just brought here because they could function in the environment that was here. We have, you know, the sea had a pH, had a salinity content, had an oxygen content, whatever it was. They, whatever got delivered here, could live in that. So the terraformers, whoever was bringing them, whoever brought them here, knew what this place needed and what it could support. And then later, interestingly enough, as we would have these catastrophes, you know, we've had five major catastrophes that have wiped out anywhere from 50% to 90% of all life forms.
And quite a few minor.
And several minor ones, exactly. I mean, it's hard to call a catastrophe minor, but if it's under 50%, yeah, it's minor. I know. But nonetheless, after each one, shortly after, a few thousand years, they let, you know, the Earth settles into the new environment, whatever the new environment is, and the catastrophe causes changes. Whatever the new environment is, boom, life just starts appearing like popcorn all over the place. You have really a series of small Cambrian explosions where lots of new life forms come and fill the spots, fill what's there. You know, they make niches, ecological niches of their own. Now, what science says, of course, is that, well, nature has some way, Darwinian evolution has a way in punctuated equilibrium of when it can go along smoothly and regularly and normally, like, you know, Darwin imagined, it does. But when there's a catastrophe and there's a need, somehow it knows that it has to hit the accelerator and go really, really fast. And now, it either is a slow, steady, gradual process, as they insist that it is, or it's not. They can't have it both ways, but they, in order to make Darwinian evolution fit the facts, which everybody understands, then it can't be all one thing. It has to be that it goes slow when it can and it goes fast when it needs to. And the reality of it is that it just doesn't work. They're just, you know, peeing up a rope, as we say. You just can't do it. Yeah. And get away with it. I mean, they do get away with it because they are who they are. Right. And they have the credentials and they have the platform. And we said so, by God. You know, that kind of thing.
The Earth travels around the sun. The Earth travels around the sun. Deal with it.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but I've got this telescope here. Really, I just want you to look. Put your eye here and look there. Okay, triangulate.
It doesn't matter what I see. I'm telling you the way it is. You know, you're going to believe me or your lying eyes. You know that famous joke.
Yeah.
But that's pretty much what we're up against.
What we're talking about is stock species.
That's what I like to call them, stock species. It's like stock species are brought. Now, I am not saying that there is no form of evolution on Earth, because obviously microevolution exists. What Darwin saw was microevolution. And let's be clear on these two terms. It's very critically important to understanding. Microevolution is changes in parts of a body to adapt to an environment. What Darwin saw on the Galapagos Islands were finches that on each island had chosen specialized diets. Some would eat nuts, some would eat worms, some would eat grubs in trees, and they needed a different beak size and shape to eat these different specialized diets. Well, over thousands of years of these finches being stranded on these islands, they developed those adaptations in their beaks. In every other way, they were finches. The stock species of finch that supposedly flew out from the mainland, from Chile or Brazil or wherever in South America, but that finch, they were all still finches. Now, the tortoises, same thing, the big land tortoises. On some islands, the tortoises could browse on shrubbery that grew off the ground at ground level. But on other islands, the shrubbery they couldn't get it until it was up about to us on us about waist height. So the shells of the low browsing turtles, the shell came right down to like a normal turtle, like you see a normal turtle shell. But the high browsing tortoises, they had a big notch in the front of their shell so their neck could lift up way high so they could get that higher food. That was microevolution, change in a body part as an adaptation. I agree with that. That's obvious around us. There are many more examples than that. But what Darwin did, the mistake that Darwin made and that his followers make, is that he said, well, if we can prove that there is microevolution, then a neat way to explain everything is to extrapolate that microevolution carried on for tens of thousands and millions of years could produce anything, any degree of change can occur over time. And so that's what Darwin latched onto, and that's what his followers have latched onto. They have extrapolated macroevolution from the visible microevolution, when in fact macroevolution can't be seen, it can't be found, because as Darwin himself said, what's going to be required are transitional species. You're going to have to be able to find species in transition, one thing clearly becoming another thing, and at the macro level, not just at the micro level. That's the missing link. You always hear science talking about, we found the new missing link, we found the new missing link, we found another missing link. They don't ever find a real missing link, because if they did, there would be no need to announce it anymore. Right. There are no missing links. They never have found one. They're never going to find one. Macroevolution does not work. It isn't there. And it's one of these big humbug things that they just keep going and keep. It's like a balloon they keep in the air, knowing full well that, you know, it's going to pop one of these days. Well, it's just not true.
The coelacanth has had, what, 65 million years to macro-evolve?
Right. Well, to micro-evolve. Yeah, it hasn't even...
Macro. I mean, it could be, a dolphin now if it wanted to. Well, it's had millions and millions and millions of years to macro-evolve, and yet it still looks the same.
Right. Well, what I've come, looking at it, guys, and I don't have any proof of this yet, but I'm working at it. I think things are brought from elsewhere. I think things that are brought here come from elsewhere. And so on some planets, I think things don't really change at all, like coelacanths. They don't have it built into them to even microevolve. And some things here are like that. They don't change at all. They come... They stay the way they are, and they go extinct, and there's no real substantial visible change at all. Keep in mind, like 90% of what's ever been here has gone extinct for one reason or another. So it's brought here, it lives, it doesn't change much, and the coelacanth is an example of that. But other things, like the finches, like the tortoises, do have it within their genetic capacity to microevolve, and that's what I think. It depends on where they come from. Some places you have microevolution is possible, and other places apparently it's not possible. And I think the coelacanth is a classic example of something that just isn't going to microevolve no matter what. It's going to be what it is. As you say, it's been what it is for many millions of years, and there's just no sign of any change in it at all. So that's just my guess. I can't prove it yet, but I'm working in that direction.
Well, I mean, one of the biggest problems that I had, since I was a young person with Darwin's theory was that, humans themselves, if we came out of Africa as the, most people think, and we have, we traveled north to Northern Europe and eventually Asia and different areas. How did we change, our color? Right now, if you take an individual who is African descent and you put him into a different climate, I think he can leave him there for the next couple of million years. I doubt he's going to change, their skin color.
Well, race is one of the major, major unknowns still in this field that I work on. Race and blood type. Those are two of the great mysteries still that don't have good answers, certainly don't have good answers from the mainstream, and don't have good answers from me either. And I'm, you know, I'm free to admit it. When I don't know something, they're not.
Couldn't an expert alien race who are experts in genetics make as many varieties as they want?
Absolutely. They could do that and could well have done that. But also, and this is important to understand, Scott, also they could have brought different races from different places here.
That's a good point.
Because they knew those races could survive in this environment. You see what I mean?
That's a very good point.
We could be a standard model from in other places, in other planets.
Isn't our history and you know, most cultures, you know, when they talk about gods or God, that, you know, we look like them. You know, God made us like himself. So
when you read what the Sumerians wrote 2,000 years before the Bible in their stone tablets, they said that the Anunnaki said, let us make the Adamu, A-D-A-M-U, let us make the Adamu in our own image after our own likeness. And so they wanted to make a slave and a servant that looked like them so that, I mean, let's, you know, to just say it the way it is, so they could have sex with them. Because the ones that came here were dominantly males. And, you know, you get, you know, 550 guys and maybe 50 women, you've got a problem. And so one of the problems they were trying to solve is cantankerousness among, you know, the men that were here, the males that were here of the Anunnaki. So in creating a slave and a servant, they wanted it to be physically attractive enough to them where they could take for themselves wives, all of which they chose, and they didn't necessarily mean wives, just concubines, you know. But this is what seems to have been the case. So there's a lot of speculation, and it really treads off into some very, very sensitive areas when you start discussing what was the first Adamu. And then how did humans begin to spread out from there? And how did the mixing with the Anunnaki go? And, you know, it's a minefield. But it has to be dealt with, and I understand that it does. That's why I say the concepts of race and the concepts of the blood types, those are two real big mystery areas that do not have good data, do not have good research yet. Because also it's possible, it's not impossible, that the races are evidence of microevolution. So that when we did move out of Africa to go to different places, that in fact your skin does lighten as you get out of areas where there's a lot of sun. You know, our bodies do not produce vitamin D. We have to absorb it in it through our skin. And so, or take for us supplements, but back then, you know, everybody was out in the sun. You were getting at least enough on your hands and your face to survive. But if you're in a place where there's very little sun, you need lighter skin. But you have the Norwegians with their very pale, light skin, the Swedes, all of the Scandinavians. But then you have the Eskimos, and their skin is not light. It's not dark, but it isn't light.
But this is the problem. It's not a question of, you know, going into a different climate, right, which is, let's say, much colder, and all of a sudden the skin pigmentation is going to change. Because, right, as you said, you know, the Eskimos and you know, people that are into the northern areas, you know, don't have the same problem. You
they
know,
all don't have the same light skin. Right, yeah.
And the other thing for me was you know, the biggest problem that I had is that, okay, fine, even if you were to go as far as that with the Europeans, when you have the Chinese or the Orientals have a completely different situation there with, you know, the eyes being what they are.
Right.
Now,
exactly.
When, you know, when the humans went to that area, you know, what caused the adaptation to happen? You know, the area is no different than where we are here in North America.
Exactly.
Right.
The Orientals argue for probably more than anything else. The Orientals argue for the theory that we, all of us, the different races, are brought here from different planets because we could function here, because the planets that we come from are very like this planet, and that could well be true. Like I said,
makes the most sense, I think.
Right. Like I said, the idea of race and the idea of the different blood types are two of the really big mysteries that are still on the table and still need a lot of work and a lot of thought and research
but
and evidence.
Why would we have such a big problem, and it would sound so far-fetched that whether it was Anunnaki or whoever else might have put us here, that there would have been, you know, multiple races within their own ranks?
Well, that's it. Is it true that the Anunnaki made one kind, and then let's say they did, according to the tablets, have sex and produced hybrid beings with themselves? That doesn't mean that they wouldn't have brought others in. That doesn't mean that others out there, other than the Anunnaki, would see that, okay, well, the Anunnaki have put this kind here. Let's put, that means this from over in planet XYZ would go here as well. Why don't we bring some of them in? They'll live better here, or they'll live better in this environment. And, you know, it could have become a larger program with more people, more types of beings involved than just the Anunnaki. It's a mystery, guys. It has so many permutations. It's like a Hydra head.
Yeah.
You can always come up with a new head on the Hydra. It's if there was an answer, I would give it. I give the answer that I'm very confident. I talk about the areas I'm very confident about. Here's what we know, and we can pretty much count on this to be the way it is. And then there are these areas like this where none of us really know much about anything, and we still have a lot of research to do and a lot of discovery to make in these two particular areas of race and blood type.
Has anybody threw a question as far as the, let's say, the terraformers? Where did they come from, or better yet,
yeah, it's the standard question of who made the Anunnaki and whoever made the Anunnaki, you know, all the way back. That is called first cause. It the term for it in general is first cause. What is the first cause of everything? How did it all begin? And it's really what everybody wants to have answered. Well, guess what? There will be no answer for that in my lifetime, in your lifetime, in lifetimes to come. First cause is going to be so far beyond our reach that it's absurd to even try to figure it out. What we need to busy ourselves with is figuring out what can we know, what can we figure out for sure, what next steps on the ladder up to that truth can we make in our own time and allow those future generations that come, assuming and hoping that future generations do come. You know, everybody always says we stand on the shoulders of giants. We all do. And we become the giants, and somebody stands on our shoulders, and somebody stands on their shoulders, and onward and onward. It's going to take a long time for us to get anywhere near understanding first cause, because we can't even figure out our own cause right now. But once we get our own cause figured out and we can begin to move up into other, you know, other levels of knowledge, but beyond this kindergarten Stone Age level that we're at, relatively speaking, I don't know how many generations it'll take. I don't know how many centuries. But first cause is out there. There is an answer, but we're I think years and centuries away from getting to that. And and to get there, we have to create a stepping stone or a few stepping stones in our own time, in our own generation. Just like generations have created stepping stones for us to move higher in our level of knowledge, but we're still abysmally ignorant. And even knowing the things that I know, all it tells me is, God, I wish I knew this, like the thing about race or the thing about blood types or other things that I don't really know nearly enough about.
Right, cultures all over the world, indigenous people talking about their outlook on where their beginnings came from, and a vast amount talk about how they were brought here from the stars or how, you know, the gods created them. They're talking in their you know, indigenous cultures about this as well. I mean, it's not just, we're not just coming up with this story.
No, all of the ancient cultures, pretty much to a man, they all say, you know, we were put here. We were created by beings from the heavens, star beings. They have all kinds of names for them, and all the old cultures have that. But you would think somebody would listen to that some of the consistency of it would impress science, but it doesn't, because science has decided all of that is just myth, just, you know, the ramblings of natives, and it's just not to be considered at all. When in fact the real myths are what mainstream science teaches. It's just pure mythology. It's just absolutely pure mythology. It's not grounded in facts. It's not grounded in reality. It's just a set of just-so tales that makes it look like they know what they're doing and they know what's going on, because that is their job. In our society and in our culture, you stick the letters PhD after somebody's name, and that gives them a sense of entitlement to knowing stuff. So even though they don't, you know, they don't know most, what they know is their tree. I mean, you get a PhD, you know, a tree in some forest really, really well. You don't have any view of the forest at all, but you know that tree. And that's the problem. They don't have any generalists. They don't have people that step back from the trees and try to look at what the whole forest is trying to, you know, express to us. And that, it's just, it makes them abysmally ignorant. It really does.
Yeah.
They're smart in their one thing, but in everything else, they spend so much time on the tree, they just don't learn anything about the forests around them. And you know, it's unfortunate, but that's what holds us back. It really is what holds us back from making those big leaps forward. And it's, you know, it's just sad, but it's the way we have to play the game.
I would even go further and say they know a knot on the side of the tree.
You know, exactly.
An acorn.
They do. They know their trees. You have to admire them for that. But it gives them a sense of hubris and arrogance that they know more than everybody, than anybody that's not in their field. Well, how could, you know, somebody not in their field know more than they know? Well, it depends on what you go after. If you go after the forest rather than the trees, you can see an awful lot more than they do. But they lose track of it, and they will. It's just, you can't convince them that they're not completely on top of their game, and they're just really not.
Yeah, I think with the story of specialists, is specialists will eventually become so specialized they'll know absolutely everything about nothing.
Or one very small set of things. Very small set of things. Their mistake is extrapolating. It's just like Darwin extrapolating the microevolution into macroevolution. Their mistake is extrapolating the great depth of their knowledge about one tree into imagining that they have a grasp of the forest in which that tree is placed. And in almost every case, they're not even in the ballpark. And it's unfortunate, but again, they set the rules. This is what's unfortunate about it, is mainstream science, has established the ground rules, laid out the field, built the stadium, and hired all the referees. And if you got to go in there and go up against them, it's going to be a hard game. but you know, they play hardball, and you just got to buckle your chin strap every day and get in there and do the best you can. And that's what I do. and again, not just me, others do it as well, but that's what I do. I go about the process of challenging them on their own terms, to the best of my ability, in their own stadium, on their own field, playing with their referees so that everything is stacked against me, except I've got the one thing they don't have, which is the truth. And so yeah. I know I'm going to win in the end. I may not win here immediately, but you can read the ebook and see I am going to win these things. You can just, even in the ebook, there's enough information there for anybody of reasonable intelligence to see and understand that the points that I make are much more obviously correct than the points that I'm challenging.
You know, I'm amazed at the arrogance of humanity and you know, if we call them scientists, that they can go out and give theories about this Big Bang idea and giving specific dates as to how old the universe is.
Right.
I find that amazing, because in an infinite universe, how could you possibly give time?
Well, because they feel like, you know, they feel obligated. They feel obligated to produce those kinds of answers. And so one of their number does. And then when that person does, if it sounds even remotely reasonable, they all swing in behind it. And that becomes part of their dogma and that they defend. I mean, science, honestly, guys, science is a religion. It has all of the trappings of a religion. It has, you know, it has set pieces that you are just obligated to believe, to take on faith, and to not allow challenges. And if you hear a challenge, you're supposed to just ignore it and not accept it into the realm of consideration, because it is contradictory to the dogma. It is so much. I read this essay one time exploring the relationship of science to religion, the way it structures itself. You know, you have the high priests, you have the acolytes, you have the working, you have the learning of the special language, the secret code, the secret language. It's all there. It's all there. Science is a religion. It just runs parallel to religion in just about every way, including adherence and strict adherence to the dogma, and those who do not adhere to the dogma are excommunicated. I mean, if you want to get out of science in a hurry, just start openly challenging any of the main dogmas, and you're gone. Or they will do everything they can to get you gone. It's not a fun world to live in if you are an independent thinker. But the beauty of science, one of the very smart things that it does, is it has that PhD process where you go to college and you get a BA or a BS, and then you get your master's another 2 or 3 years, and then you get a PhD another 2 or 3 years after that. Well, in all that time, you're being carefully evaluated. And if you show yourself to be an independent thinker, if you show yourself to be somebody who keeps sticking your hand up and challenging the professor, challenging the boss, challenging the grad student, just challenging, 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 if you're that kind of person, they weed you out. You know, independent thinkers are not wanted at the PhD level. And it's just the way the system works. So that when you get through that winnowing process and you get to the other side of it and you become a PhD, you are a master of groupthink. Because if you're not, you don't get it. So that is why they have such great homogeneity in their support of their various paradigms and dogmas, because the system demands it. It won't let people, like me, for example, not that I tried to go through, and I'm really glad that I didn't. I wouldn't have made it. But anybody like me with an independent bent of mind, I would have been in there challenging the whole way. I mean, that's just the kind of person I am. And I there would have been no home for me there at all, and there isn't for anybody like me. So my job is to teach for the Invisible College. It's called the Invisible College. I'm an instructor in the Invisible College, which is where you go when you want information that the mainstream won't provide. You go to the Invisible College. And so I'm one of the professors at that.
Yeah. And your PhD doesn't stand for piled higher and deeper.
Yeah, that's one of the favorites.
What is the importance of the Miocene period?
The Miocene period is the most important for humans, well, the most interesting, let's say, because that is when you have the beginning of apes on the Earth. And that's at about 23 million years ago. The Miocene period is from 23 million years ago to about 5 million years ago. Prior to that, for the 10 million years prior to that, from about 33 to 35 million years ago to about 23 million years ago, monkeys dominated. Monkeys were the dominant primates all over the planet. Now, let's keep in mind what a monkey is. It's got a tail, right? It's a slender being, slender creature with a tail that scampers around in trees and spends very little time on the ground. It's a tree animal, monkeys. But then at about 23 million years ago came apes, Miocene apes, they're called. In the Miocene period, Miocene apes. And the apes began to dominate, take over from the monkeys. The monkeys don't go away. They're just more apes, it seems, at least in the fossil record, it seems to be. The apes began to flourish. And it isn't just the four major kinds that we have today, the chimps, the gorillas, the gibbons, and the orangs. It isn't that. It's about anywhere from 50 to 100 different species, supposedly. Now, I don't think personally that it's necessarily 50 to 100, but it could be 20 or 30. It's certainly some variety there. And those apes, all of them are considered to be quadrupeds like the chimps and the gorillas, or if they were what's called short-armed apes, meaning there were long-armed apes and there were short-armed apes in the Miocene. The long-armed apes had arms longer than their legs, and they became quadrupeds, because if your arms are longer than your legs, walking quadrupedally is the most comfortable way for you to go. And then there were the short-armed apes. Relative to the long arms, their arms are short, but they were the same length as their legs. So they couldn't walk quadrupedally as easily as the long arms, so how did they walk? Well, science projects or speculates that they just were all stooped over, walking along with their knuckles dragging on the ground. It's called knuckle dragging. And, you know, it's kind of ridiculous, because why would they do that? That's a very uncomfortable way to walk. I mean, you just try to do it. Our arms aren't as long as their arms, but you just walk with your bent over with your arms, say 6 feet, or with your hands, say 6 inches to a foot from the ground, and you see how far you can go before you really are hurting. So the knuckle dragging thing is just something they made up because they didn't want to contemplate the idea that these short-arm Miocene apes with arms the length of their legs were actually standing upright, were actually bipedal, because they can't allow for bipedality until the first prehumans. And the first prehumans can't appear until there is a split with chimps and humans from their common ancestor between 5 and 8 million years ago. This is the way science has decided that it had to go. For evolution to work, for Darwinian evolution to work, there has to be a common ancestor between chimps and humans between 5 and 8 million years ago, and out of that evolves slowly, gradually, incrementally evolves humans and chimps from the common ancestor that we both shared in that window 5 to 8 million years ago. And then every prehuman, the upright walking creatures that look like apes, upright apes, that would be, again, the Australopithecines, Lucy, the famous Lucy, the early Homos, Homo habilis, and then Homo erectus, and then Homo ergaster, and then Neanderthals. All of those upright walking apes are called prehumans. So if there were to be an upright walking Miocene ape way prior, say at 9 million years ago or 10 million years ago or, you know, heaven forbid, 20 million years ago, the whole theory of evolution is just blown up. Or as we say down here, whoever is is putting that forth as a blowed up peckerwood. Well, they science becomes a group of blowed up peckerwoods if there are upright walking Miocene apes anywhere beyond, you know, 5 to 8 million years ago. Well, they're there. They are there. And all you have to do is you know, read various books about it. And I certainly talk about...
I was going to ask you about, does that connect in any way? What does the finding in A.G. Piller's book, the upright ape, mean? And what is modular evolution?
Evolution, yeah. Aaron Fuller, Dr. Aaron Fuller, is a guy who became a certified anthropologist. I mean, he really understood anthropology. And then he went on to become a thoracic surgeon. So there's really hardly anybody in the world that knows spinal bones the way he does. And there is a fossil at 22 million years ago called Morotopithecus. And Morotopithecus is a series of about a dozen bones, one of which is a spine bone. And at 22 million years ago, 21 million years ago, that spine bone looks just like a human spine bone. It looks like the spine bone of an upright walking creature. And so, that being the case, Fuller has written a book. Now, keep in mind, Fuller is as mainstream gets. He is putting forth a radical, radical theory, but he is still a mainstream person. So he's not getting as radical as I am. I just take his stuff and I just push it out to its more logical conclusion. But what he is saying, what he is suggesting, is that upright bipedal apes, Miocene apes, came first, and that the quadrupeds somehow came to specialize in quadrupedal locomotion, and that they came second. Now, when he put that book out, obviously all of his peers just, you know, thought he had lost his mind. But if you read his book, if anybody reads his book, it's a little difficult, but not overwhelmingly difficult. You'll see. He's right. He is absolutely right. He shows, and not just Morotopithecus, and there are others like Oreopithecus, and that was a very strange foot on that one. It's more like a bird foot, a very almost tripod-like. But it just shows that feet are a great subject of interest to me. And in the new ebook, Intervention Theory Essentials, any reader will see I go into a discussion of feet quite a bit, because feet tell a lot, because tracks tell a lot about whatever made those tracks. So we talk about feet and we talk about tracks, and anybody that comes away from reading the book will have a valuable understanding of how that whole process works. And so the feet of Oreopithecus, which we have, shows a radically different foot than what humans have, but it's still a bipedal foot. So it shows that there's some variation you can have and still have bipedality. So it's very, very likely that within the Miocene, there were a lot of bipeds. A lot, but we don't have a lot of full body fossils from that time, or particularly feet or hand bones from that time. What we do have, though, indicate that our spine bones, the key in the case of Morotopithecus is the spinal bone, but also the scapula as well. Anyway, this gets complicated. It's easier, I think, to read this in the ebook than to try and talk about it, because it'll be confusing.
Right. And I will have a link. I will have a link to your book on the upcoming shows, as well as the, if you go the next day, you'll see it in the archives. The full show will be there at www.spectrumradionetwork.com. I'll probably link one of your YouTube lectures as well, just to give people a you know, an idea about what you've talked about in the past, and a link to your page that you've made up for this ebook specifically.
Right, and that's a good one to direct them to is the Intervention Theory page subsite. It's I have the Intervention Theory subsite to the LloydPye.com website, and a lot of good information is in there as well. But just make sure that everybody understands that it is an ebook. Everything You Know Is Wrong is a book, and Intervention Theory Essentials is an ebook. And I would urge people to start with the ebook and get a grounding in this subject. And if you like what you read there in those 3 hours, then get Everything You Know Is Wrong, and you know you're looking at 10 or 12 hours or whatever it takes to read a book of that size for you. So
that, yeah, totally. That's totally. We'll have all that up there. Okay, so did you explain modular evolution?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. And modular evolution, that got away from me. The Darwinian evolution of gradual bit-by-bit change due to mutations, a little change here, a little change there. Most mutations are negative. They're not passed on. Some are neutral. They don't have an effect one way or the other. And some few are positive and they cause some small bit of advantage. So the positive ones can be passed into the gene pool and do something constructive if enough of them come together at the right times in the right way. And that's how Darwinists explain evolution. But everybody can see that just doesn't really work. I mean, it's obvious that doesn't really work. It's like the lightning bolts hitting the water with the building blocks. It's a nice simplified fantasy for those who don't really want to bother with thinking any deeper than that. And most people don't. That's just the simple fact of the matter is most people are just satisfied with the lightning bolt hit the water and, oh my gosh, I don't have to think about it anymore and I'm really happy about that. And then, of course, there's always the one or two kids in the back of the room saying, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. And, you know, those are the ones that become us. So, yeah. But as far as modular evolution, Aaron Fuller is one of those people that understands that, you know, the gradual thing just doesn't work. So what he and the other modular evolutionists have come up with is that change occurs not in mutation by mutation, gene by gene, but in whole suites of genes at the same time in what are called master genes, like the Hox genes, where you have to imagine with Darwin a common ancestor chimp-like head evolving slowly into the human head. It's really hard to imagine how you could have an intermittent thing where it was working like or an eye or anything that functions. Like, how does it work just a little bit? How do you get an eye before it's an eye? How's a partial eye work? How does a partial heart work? How does a partial kidney work? You know, it doesn't. As things were evolving, it doesn't make sense really when you think about it. Mm. How do the partials work?
So these guys
say that it happens in huge chunks, that the whole head changes, boom.
So like a molecular lightning bolt.
Yeah, well, like a genetic lightning bolt.
Genetically, yeah.
The whole master gene, and there are master genes, the whole master gene, it changes out, changes. It just, poof, it's like swapped out with something else almost. And then other parts of the body, like the trunks, has something, the whole master gene in the trunk or the arms or the legs or, you know, that the change is wholesale rather than piecemeal. And, you know, you can make that argument if you want, except that what happens in the lab is this. When they make changes, severe, radical genetic changes to fruit flies, they nearly always work with fruit flies because it has a simple genome. They can get in there and cut and splice very easily. They have a short life cycle, and they can watch and see what happens. So they make up all these creative fruit flies. They take the, you know, the hind legs and put them on where the antennas are supposed to be, and they put the antennas where the hind legs are supposed to be, and they put the anus where the mouth is and the mouth where the anus is, and just goof it around any way they want and make these incredibly crazy screwed up fruit flies. And yet, if they can still breed, and they let them breed, they will breed right back to normal fruit flies within a matter of just two or three generations. It's astounding. And what that means is that the genetic package of everything has windows within which it can change, but beyond which it can't. Like, for example, in the natural world, a wolf is pretty much a wolf. You don't get a lot of range in wolves. Polar bears are pretty much polar bears. You don't get a lot of range of size and difference in polar bears. But dogs, which are a domesticated animal, you get a wide range in there. You get from Chihuahuas to Great Danes. With horses, another domestic animal, you get a wide range there. You can get from Little Shetlands up to the Clydesdales or the Percherons or Percherons, the really big ones. You can have wide ranges in domesticated plants and animals, but you don't get very wide ranges in the natural world with natural species. So the idea of the wholesale change of the modular genetics is still being worked out, because while the master genes are there and it's clear that they can create profound change, if you fool with them in the lab, it doesn't seem to hold up in the real world. When you let things be themselves, they go right back to what they're supposed to be rather than the genetic engineering that's been done on them. So that's in our labs. Now, that doesn't mean that somebody that knows a lot more about it than we do couldn't make all kinds of chimeras. And apparently the Anunnaki could do that, speaking of them again, because there are reports back from the time of the Sumerians where very, very weird, strange things were out and about in the land. And that's where you get the theory, myths and legends of,
Minotaur.
Like Minotaur. I was trying to think, Pegasus. What was a flying horse?
Centaurs.
Centaurs. Those things are not necessarily impossible. If you know what you're doing with genetics, you can do it. But we can't yet. We haven't figured out. We're again stone tools in our hands. And in the realm of genetics, we're honestly in the Stone Age. I know that it seems like we're not, but the truth of it is that we are. We don't even know yet what 95% of our own genome does. The junk, what's called junk DNA. Well, they don't call it, junk anymore, because they know it can't be junk if it's being so carefully preserved by each body, each person, on through time. It's being preserved because it's so big and it's so complex and it's taking, so much of our body resources to produce all right. that junk. If only 5% of our genome is doing the work, what the heck's it all there for? Well, it's there for some reason. It's like, we're as ignorant of that as we are of the universe. But we try to pretend that we're not by parlaying what little we do know to make it seem like our geneticists are really on top of their game, when in fact they're just absolutely the blind leading the blind. They're just doing the best they can. I certainly give them full credit for doing the best they can, but for them to pretend like they really have a good grip on the whole thing is ridiculous. They have a grip on where they are now, and they don't have a good grip on that. But tomorrow they'll have a little better grip, and tomorrow they'll have a better grip still. It's a process, and right. we are in the Stone Age of that process, I'm sure.
If we're talking about your theory, humans were adapted from hominoids. Bigfoot, Yeti, Almas, and Agagwe are the four types. If you could give us some details on that, like where they're from, where they're located,
and maybe some of the Sumerian, you can mix in some of the Sumerian information there as well.
Well, the Sumerians don't really have that much information about it, but the basic for hominoids is this. They are all over the world, on every continent except Antarctica. I know this is shocking to everybody that hears it because they've been brainwashed to believe that Bigfoot and all is, you know, just a crock, but it isn't at all. They're very well known and understood in all these places. People make the mistake of thinking that humans dominate in every part of the world, on the land of every part of the world. It is not true. We dominate on one-third of the arable land of the earth. One of the other thirds is desert and snow and ice and tundra and all. And the third one is deep, heavy forests, jungles, and swamps. Those areas are dominated by the hominoids. We don't live there. We skirt the edges of those places. We might traipse through them occasionally, but we don't really live there. That's where the hominoids live. There are four kinds. There is the giant kind, which are the Bigfoot, Sasquatch kind. There is a man-sized kind called the Yeti and the Abominable Snowman. They are a more primitive type, and they are confined to the Himalayan ranges. The five ranges of the Himalayas are collectively the size of the United States, so there's plenty of room for them to roam. Then you have another man-sized kind that are called the Almas or Kaptars, and they dominate basically in areas of Russia, mountainous areas of Russia. But there are also those kinds in the other continents as well. And then you have the pygmy kind, the Sedapas and the Agagways, and they dominate in the jungles that form the band around the equator, the bands of land around the equator that are jungles. That's where the Agagways and the Sedapas live. And one of the recent findings that everybody knows about, the hobbits, that was an Agagway-Sedapa type being, even though those that have found it say, well, it just has to be some kind of deformed or screwed up human, some little human, some dwarf human. Not so. There's not a human bone in its body, and even those that found it and have studied it will admit that. There's just not a human corollary in the body of the hobbit. It is not a human being. It is one of the hominoid types. It is a skeleton of a hominoid that was alive 14,000 years ago or whatever it was, but they are alive today. You talk to the people of the islands of Indonesia, they all have names for them. The name on the island of Flores is Ibu Gogo. These things are real. They are around the world, and they live in the environmental niches of this planet that we essentially do not inhabit. We think we do, but the reality of it is that we don't, period. We don't. And it's really a shock when I say this, when I lecture, this is one of the things that really rocks people back on their heels the most, because they're just so convinced that we know everything about everything relative to our planet. And it is just not true.
I was going to ask about reports all over the world of these hominoids. What are we looking at as far as reports go? And are there any good books out there that talk about reports of the hominoids?
Well, sure. There are literally thousands of encounter reports. And there are many good books out there. A good one is that one that I talked about from 1961-62, Ivan Sanderson's Abominable Snowmen, Legend Come to Life. You can find that reprinted in modern editions. But the one that I like, the modern one that is, in my opinion, the best, is Know the Sasquatch / Bigfoot. Know the Sasquatch Bigfoot. And this is a sequel to an earlier book called Meet the Sasquatch. So you can find either one of those by Christopher L. Murphy, Chris Murphy. And Chris has done these, like, equivalent of soft cover coffee table books, big, well done, tremendous number of illustrations and photos, and just tremendous work. So I would urge anybody that wants to go in depth into the whole hominoid issue to check out either one of those two. But there are other books as well in the field that are good. But I think those two are, in my opinion, best.
Wasn't there an Alma that was captured and they used basically as slave labor? I know we talked about this on our previous show.
Right.
But I just want to bring it up again because it's such an amazing story because she had descendants.
Right. Well, this is one of the highlights, actually, of both Everything You Know Is Wrong, the book, but also the new ebook. It is one of the things that I'm getting some of the most comments about is Zanna because of the incredible story that they have about her in Russia, but also because now I was able to produce some photos of her family that have been gathered by the Russian researchers that have done the work on her story over the past 50 years now. Zanna was an Alma's type hominoid, which I think, and the Russians think as well, I should add, is a living Neanderthal type creature. And Zanna was a female who was captured in about 1850 in just a backwoods area of Russia. And she was turned into a slave, a physical labor slave, where she would fetch water, fetch wood, carry heavy sacks to the mill and back, and whatever grunt work there was to do in a village, she would do it because she was strong. All primates are 5 to 10 times stronger than humans, pound for pound, and she was a primate. Hair covered, described exactly like everybody describes. Look at the Patterson film, the famous Patterson film. That's more or less how Zanna is described, looking like that.
Yes.
So she's there being a work slave, but also she is a sex slave. Men in the village and villages around, and I'm sure Randy, teenage boys have their way with her whenever they want, apparently. So over the 40 years that she's there, from about 1850, nobody knows how old she was when she was captured, but it seems that she was fairly young, but not for sure. And then she died in about 1890. So in those 40 years, she produced 8 offspring with the men of the village. Now, the first 4, she did whatever her kind is supposed to do, either instinctually or what they had learned or been taught. She took the newborns directly to a nearby stream, which is an absolutely freezing cold mountain stream. And the children, the offspring, looked in every way human. They weren't hair covered like her or any. They looked human. And she took them into that water, washed them off, and they drowned and died from the shock of the cold. And so in those small rural Russian villages of that time, every pair of hands was valuable. So the last 4 of her births, the women of the village took the babies from her and raised them as part of their families. And the last 4 all made it to adulthood, 2 females and 2 males. And so they grew up and they showed parts of her in themselves. They were big. They were robust. They were strong. They had darker skin, wiry hair. They showed parts of her, but they were human. They were human. The one thing they could do that she couldn't do for sure was they could talk. They could speak. They had all that. They were not covered in hair like she was, head to toe. None of that. They were dominantly human. So however that hybridization process works between humans and Almas, what comes out is dominantly a human. And more than that, in hybrids, frequently you have sterile offspring. That was not the case with her. All of her children were fertile. They produced children. They produced families.
And you have pictures of them in your e-book.
We have pictures of some of them. We have her youngest son, Kvit, when she died. Let's go back to how we know about all this. In the 1960s, a Russian named Boris Porchnev heard about her story, and he was researching hominoid stuff. And so he heard about her story, went to the village, and found that in the middle 1960s, there were over a dozen people this is a long-lived area where people live well up over 100 years routinely. There were over a dozen people that had been at her funeral. When she was buried, they were there. They saw it. But it's a Muslim area of Uzbekistan, and so they Azerbaijan, if I recall right. Anyway, wherever, it's a Muslim area, and so they don't mark their graves. So 50 years later, they couldn't, 60 years later, they couldn't decide exactly where. They just knew they were there. They thought it was under a tree or near a tree, but they couldn't be sure. And they weren't exactly sure of the year, but they guessed it was in around 1890 that she died. So her son, her youngest son, Kvit, who had been born only 5 years earlier, about 1875, not long before she died of apparently old age, of apparently natural causes, he made it to the age of about 70 in 1954. He died and was buried. So they remembered where he was. The village remembered 54, and they're doing the research in about 64. So it's only about 10 years earlier. Kvit, the youngest son of Zana, had died. So they were able to dig his body, exhume his skull. So I have pictures of that. You can see, just compared to a normal human skull, it's very much bigger and very much more Neanderthal looking than a normal human. But still, he was human. They have a picture of him, and they have a picture of his children he married and all of that. So the key to all this is that Zana's female line, the line that Zana produced of her two daughters, their children, their female children and grandchildren, they're all going to have Zana's mitochondrial DNA, because mitochondrial DNA passes down through the females. So all anybody's got to do that's really get serious about it, and I would be at the front of the pack if I had the money to do it, go find her relatives from her female line, take some of their DNA, check the mitochondrial DNA, and see if you can find any significant differences from human, and you should be able to. So this is one of the things that could easily be done if science really wanted to know the answers here. If science really wanted to stir this hornet's nest, which they don't. They will not make any attempt to do that. If that gets done, that's going to be because somebody like me gets the opportunity to do it. And, of course, assuming I do well with the Star Child, as I think I'm going to do, that's one of the things that's on my agenda to do. I'll be working with the Zana story. I'll be working with Coneheads in Peru. I mean, I have plans to be as big a thorn in the side of the mainstream as I can for as long as I can.
Yeah.
I want to ask you again about the Star Child and where you're at with that.
Well, we're doing pretty well, actually. We've recovered about 10% of its mitochondrial DNA, and that 10% shows that if you extrapolate it out, and remember, extrapolating can be dangerous, but nonetheless, we feel very confident because mitochondrial DNA is so highly conserved and so well understood that an extrapolation of that 10% is not at all out of line. And if you do that, what we have already recovered indicates that the Star Child is approximately 800% different from humans. 800%. I know. But that's where we are right now with the DNA of the mitochondrial DNA. Now, with the nuclear DNA, that's much more complicated. You know, mitochondrial DNA is only like 15,569 base pairs long. Nuclear DNA is 3 billion plus base pairs long. So it's a much bigger package. And so the fragments that have been recovered out of that have mostly been in the area that doesn't function, the area of junk, so there's not a lot we can tell about it. There's really only been one fragment recovered out of a working segment. And that in and of itself is very interesting, but because it's only one fragment, it's not enough to really go to the wall with. We just, as our geneticist, you know, finds time and has the ability to do it, he has his regular job, and until we get the money that we need as an investment from somebody to, you know, basically buy the time of the lab and the geneticist, and not just him, but other people that have to work on it as well. We're talking obviously a great deal of money, but once we have that and we can do that, then they will be able to focus and recover that whole genome. But everything we've seen up to this point, guys, everything indicates that it's going to be an alien and not, as we thought for a very long time, an alien-human hybrid, but actually a real, true, all-the-way alien. So we're very excited about where we are, and it's just a matter of keeping to putting it in front of people with money and finding the one who's going to say, yeah, right, I want to do this. I want to be a part of this.
That is different from our last interview, which was almost a year ago. It was 10 months ago. That is a different conclusion or hypothesis. We were thinking back then that it was a human-alien hybrid, and there would be a small degree of difference, but noticeable enough so that you could say definitely different.
Right. But now we know better. It's the test that we had, the DNA test that we had in 2003, indicated that it was a human-alien hybrid. At the time, that was the best they could do. That was just the best technology that they had. But now the technology with DNA recovery is so much more sophisticated. And so instead of getting those little bitty, you know, 30 to 50 base pair long chips that they were getting back in 2003, the geneticist now is getting them in the hundreds and a couple thousand. A few of those fragments were a couple thousand base pairs long. So it's much, much more sensitive, and it gives you a much clearer, when you're looking at hundreds of base pairs long, you're getting a much better, and plus much more is known about the human genome and about all other genomes. There's a massive database now at the National Institutes of Health that you can compare any unknown DNA that you have to that database and see where it all fits. And that's how we know that parts of the Star Child's nuclear DNA are indeed human-like, and other parts of it, other strings of it, other fragments of it, are not. Not found in the database, not human-like, not anything-like, not on Earth. So we know that the Star Child is an alien being. What we have to do is prove that to a level of certainty where science just can't say anything. They're just absolutely have to sit down and shut up and deal with it. Well, till we get to that point, the only way to get to that point is through the recovery of its entire genome, all of its mitochondria, and all of its nuclear DNA. That's within capacity. That's within the technology. All it's not within so far is our financial grasp. But we work all the time on trying to find the kind of people with the money, the level of money. We're talking just, you know, a few million dollars, so we're talking
and that price will go down as technology gets better.
No, people are forever writing me to say, well, you know, it doesn't cost that much anymore. What's your problem? Why can't you get it done now? It costs less than $10,000 to get a genome. Yeah, if it's your genome or my genome and they can pull our blood out and take it live and there's absolutely not the first shred of degradation, yes, it's about $10,000 to do the whole genome. But for something that's been dead for 900 years, that is badly desiccated and badly contaminated with the standard bacteria that come with death, you know, it's a hard process. It's doable. I mean, they're doing the Neanderthal, and that is 100 times harder, 1,000 times harder than the Star Child, because the Neanderthal is a fossil. It's a fossil. Star Child's bone. I mean, it's old bone. It's, you know, long dead bone. It's desiccated and contaminated. But all of the good stuff is in there. And relatively speaking, whereas it's been, what, 20 or 30 million to get the Neanderthal genome, it'll be a couple million to get the Star Child's. So okay. It isn't, you know, it's not a backbreaker. And we're not asking for anybody to just give us that money. We're looking for an investor. We want to take the money that they give us, not only for that, but to create documentary films of the processes, so that those documentary films then can then pay the investors back their money. So it's a good deal. We just have to, you know, find the right person and pitch it to them. And we do that occasionally with people, and eventually we're going to find the right one.
You would think that universities all over the world would be falling over themselves to, you know, be
they
the ones.
Not, they will not fall over themselves until we prove it. Once we prove it and it's safe and they don't have to worry about their peers excoriating them for getting involved in it, they'll be lining up, and then, of course, it'll be too late. But right now, they don't want anything to do with this. This is nothing but problems for anybody that gets involved in it, because it has been stated from on high within the authoritarian groups of mainstream science that this field is to be ignored and dismissed and ridiculed as long as possible. Because like the thing we were talking about earlier with the gravity and the electrified plasma, that this is going to change the game thoroughly from the ground up. The ground that the mainstream is standing on relative to this whole alien UFO question, it changes the world of humanity in such a profound way. Remember when we landed on the moon, we stopped being an earthbound species. We became a spacefaring species. Well, when it's proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that aliens are real, that too is going to have an equally profound impact on who we are and what we think of ourselves. It just can't be any other way.
Right. We got Lloyd's book, The Intervention Theory Essentials, is an e-book. You got to get it. I'm going to ask you one quick thing before we go, and it has to do with chromosomes. All higher primates carry 48 chromosomes. Humans only have 46. How did we lose two whole chromosomes?
Well, we didn't lose them, and that's one of the fun parts of the book, and I think everybody that reads it will really enjoy learning about that. We didn't lose them. What happened was that the second and third primate chromosomes in humans are fused together end to end perfectly, so that rather than being completely, totally screwed up, they function perfectly with their ends nipped off and fused together with one of their centromeres silenced. It's so incredibly impossible what happened to make
What that. Other species on the planet has had something like that occur in their chromosomes?
Well, actually, there are things called Robertsonian translocations, but the species in which that occur are domesticated plants and animals. The things that have been obviously manipulated, you can find all kinds of funny, screwy stuff in their genomes. Multiple sets of chromosomes in certain plants. You don't have that in animals, but you do have it in plants. Things that are just, you know, ridiculous. All of these things are showing the handiwork of the geneticists that created not only us, but all the domesticated plants and animals that we just take for granted that some Stone Age, nincompoop living in a cave somehow got an idea to domesticate this animal or that animal or this crop this grass to turn into wheat, or, you know, this little grass to turn into corn, and somehow they knew how to do it when we can't do it today. We can't make new things today, but somehow they were doing it back in the Stone Ages in caveman times. It's one of the many countless absurdities that science expects us to believe, and which, incredibly, we do believe because we don't look under the covers at all. We're sheeple. I mean, it's insulting to say it, but really, humans are designed to be sheeple. We were genetically engineered to be sheeple. We were designed and genetically engineered to be slaves and servants, to just shut up and do what we were told, to listen to the bosses, and to not question. And right, for the most part, that works. And very few of us don't work right. I'm one of them. I'm one of them that I just don't work right.
And if we would have went back a couple hundred years, you might have been stoned.
Oh, I'd have been burned at the stake long ago. I wouldn't have gotten very far. No, I wouldn't.
No.
You know, and there are probably some people who would like to do some bad things to me as well. But again, it's not just me. I'm not the only one.
No.
This is it's just alternative knowledge. There is an invisible college, as I said, and there are teachers and there are students, and you know, it's a large college, and I'm very proud to be a part of it, and I like to promote it every chance I get.
Well, we talk to those people all the time, don't we, Tom? I mean, those are our guests.
We do.
And, you know, there's people that have been working in the free energy field for decades, you know, going all the way back to Nikola Tesla. And these people, and they come up with all of these inventions that immediately get squashed. It's the same sort of repression.
Do you guys ever talk to Jerry Decker, who has that KeeleyNet.com site about alternative energies, free energies and stuff? Jerry is like a hub for a lot of people. He knows a lot of the research that's going on at various levels. And whenever I have any questions at all in that area, that's who I go to. Jerry
Decker
would be a wonderful guest for you.
I'm going to definitely look into that. We've had all kinds of people on. We've had a lot of the free energy inventors, people that have been in the free energy field, Wade Frazier. Just last week, we did a two-part, last week of the week before, with free energy inventor Adam Trombley, who really doesn't do that many interviews. So we had him 2 weeks ago. And we know, of course, Wade Frazier, who was with Dennis Lee, and the list goes on and on and on. We've had quite a few people. We got stuck in that area for a while, didn't we, Tom?
Yes, we did.
Just an example of the sort of suppression that can happen in all the fields. You could be an archaeologist, and if you don't come up with the correct date, you're done. And if you stick to your guns and say, no, I mean, the date I got is the date that it is.
Right.
And if it contradicts that the academics say it should be, then you're done. You're blackballed. You're no longer in the game.
That's right.
You cannot be an archaeologist anymore. If you find giant bones and you want to bring them out, giant bones go in the basement of the museum. We don't talk about those.
Right. That's exactly right. Exactly right.
So
couldn't say it any better.
Okay, I want people to get your book, The Intervention Theory Essentials. They can also get your book, Star Child Essentials. Is it Star Child Project Essentials or just Star Child Essentials?
Star Child Skull Essentials, and it can be found at www.starchildproject.com, starchildproject.com, and the Intervention Theory Essentials can be found at lloydpye.com, lloydpye.com, and there you'll find easy access to that ebook as well as an intervention theory subsite, so with a lot of other information on it as well.
Yeah.
So you have a free sample, a free 20-page sample of the book to look at. to read so that you can decide if it's for you. It's not necessarily for everyone, but I think if you read the first 20 pages, you'll want to see the rest of it. It's very good, but just go there, take a look at the sample. If you like what you see, same thing with the Star Child ebook. There's a sample there. It'll give you a sense of whether or not you like it, and if you do, I think both of them are amazing reading experiences and amazing increases in your base of knowledge about things that really everything you know is wrong, like the title of my book, really.
And you can also, now can you also get, because I've been waiting for this to come out since Everything You Know Is Wrong came out, so can you still get the Everything You Know Is Wrong on your website, or do
you
have to?
Yeah, Everything You Know Is Wrong, you can definitely link to it, or you can through the website, obviously, LloydPye.com or StarChildProject.com, but where you go to get it, where you will be linked to, is called iUniverse, www.iUniverse.com, iUniverse.com, and that's where you ordered that.
Okay. So, yeah, I would highly recommend it. I've read it. I recommend it. The truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off. So you should definitely go out and get that book. And I'd like to thank you for your time, Lloyd, and thanks for coming on. And I know your book just got released, so I really appreciate you making time now since you're so busy.
It's always a pleasure to be on with you guys, and I'm sure that I'll be on with you again sometime in the future.
I'm sure you will be. You're one of my favorite people in the whole world. Bye, guys, and we'll see you guys next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.